Thank you very much, and thank you to Jean-Luc and Antonio for this invitation and for organizing this conference. Sorry also for the overlappings that you will see. Hermopolis' reputation as a city imbued with Greek culture relies not so much on its columns and column capitals, but mostly on the literary texts found close to its ruins in neighboring areas. Many texts are written on book rolls and codices, some or limestone or marble, as we see in the closed necropolis of Tuna el Gebel. Here, according to the survey by Etienne Bernan, 12 inscriptions out of 75 are metric, but only a few follow the layout and lettering of exposed writing, which is the category that I would suggest to follow in this case. Like this one, look at the pentameter, which is indented. Most are ink written on white background, according to the bookish layout for hexametric poetry, but in scripts, which were usually employed for documents. A documentary script is employed for the two epigrams for Isidora, who was too young when called by the Nile's nymphs. Good parallels for it can be found in the documents of the Antonine Age, as this Pifuad 10. The texts were meant to be seen, and so technically they are exposed writings. Their literary value is good, but their script and layout has nothing in common with those normally used for books. Anyway, such choice was deliberate and not a consequence of the lacking of skilled craftsmen of alternative models. We do not know the reason underlying it. The hand is clearly not used to write on such surfaces, as the different thickness of the traits show. If we suppose that it was the hand of one parent or relative, he could have chosen to write in his hand to emphasize the emotional impact of the texts. We see something similar on other funerary inscriptions. From Antinoopolis, for example, Didymus' fathers in these inscriptions, not so nice, but you can see the drawing and part of the transcription, Didymus' fathers scratched a faulty and sad dactylic tetrapody written in his hand on the funerary stone of his son, above the original epitaph, ink written in square letters by a professional. And the link between autography and emotions is clear in other private or exposed messages. Finding it in letters is pretty obvious, but sometimes it occurs in epigraphic texts besides the mourning. So, just to mention one example, Tiberius Proclus, at the end of the dedication of his dear slave Marcia to the goddess Ma in the Macedonian sanctuary of Edessa, remarks that he wrote Te emautou keiri. And similar phrases can be read on other slave dedications. They are not simply documents, but acts of piety, where orthography seems to play a specific emotional function. Whatever the reasons, all such texts, and many more can be added, we have seen them, warn us to avoid easy binary schemes, documents versus books, daily scripts versus monumental writings, and so on. The employ of a script typology was not just a direct consequence of the contents of the texts and or of its main destination, but of dynamic interactions where the medium and the expected poor public were involved as well. And the chosen script, together with the layout and eventual paratextual elements, had a communicative value in itself. Indeed, we might argue about the extent of literacy in the Hellenized world, yet we may all agree that Greek and Roman cities and towns were the ideal setting where a multilingual galaxy of written items and writing habits, books, documents, inscriptions, and above all scripts interacted, hybridized, developed in further aesthetic and practical solutions to keep documentary records or cultural memories. Greco-Roman urban environments were the incubators for any sort of graphic inventions which may intimidate or excite the imagination of historians. And both feelings are even deeper when we browse the written material from any Egyptian sites. Still, classifications were surely followed also in antiquity and nowadays are necessary. But their parameters cannot be defined as a consequence of an old approach to ancient writing, and interpreting them requires to start from some basilar questions. Who were the writers? How did they learn their scripts? And what was the Greek perception of writings? I'm sorry I won't give proper answers, I'm afraid, but only some reflections. The Greeks did not have a single word for the professionals responsible for the production of private or public documents. The oldest noun, grammateus, refers to a plurality of figures, from the responsible of the documents of a bulle in 5th century Athens as in 2nd century AD Ephesus, to any sort of subordinate officials. Managing quickly written, ligatured scripts was not per se a distinctive feature and sometimes was neither a prerequisite, as is demonstrated by Ischiron and Petaus, the two slowly writing comogrammateis. Indeed, we find a word for the craftsman skilled in bookmaking, focused on the process of writing, biblia or bibliographos. It is already attested in 5th, 4th century Athens, before Christ Athens, by comediographers Ascratinus and Antiphanes, and literary sources unmistakably associate it only with the writing of books from early Hellenistic age. We do not have much information about bibliographoi. Some of them are slaves or freedmen, as it is usual for librarii in Rome. Some others had a slightly respectable position if they were the owners of atelier, as the famous Callinos in Rome, mentioned by Greek and Latin sources, by the way. In Libanius' network, we find even one Maionios Bibliographos in Epistle 6-9, described as a trustable person. At some point, the luckiest bibliographoi could find a way to use their knowledge or handwriting for achieving a better position, as we read in this very famous epigram by Phanias, prototype for many later imitations. This composition is extremely interesting for historians of ancient writing habits, at first for its detailed list of scribes' tools, whose function is sometimes not easy to understand. What is the pleasantly shining green-blue plinthis mentioned at verse 6? But it also offers a vivid picture of the social status of book writers. What does it say? Akestondas, the speaking person, is a bibliographos who dedicates the tools of his craft to the muses because he found a better work as tax farmer. He was not a slave, but his activity was equated to a manual job and as such poorly remunerated. Becoming a telones implied a drastic change, more money so that he can finally enjoy good cakes, as it is written at the end, and the work, where writing text was just a part, not the final achievement. But this implies also that our Akestondas was imagined to be proficient in all the possible types of Greek handwritings, a nightmare for papyrologists and paleographers wishing to find hand matches. The shift from literary fiction to the sheer reality of actual uses of writing is not that abrupt. We have no evidence of professional scribes of books who turned to tax farming. But we may be confident that Telonai, as other officials, were proficient in a wide array of scripts since they had to produce texts aimed to different goals and readers. So, this famous ordinance of Ptolemy II concerning fiscal matters states that if a slave gives information on tax evasion, he shall be free. This had to be registered by different officials, and at the end, the telones was also required to write the manumission megalois grammasin, you can see it at the end, in big letters, on a leucoma, which was exposed in front of the agoranomous office. Megalois grammasin implies a slow written script, much different from the standard cursives used for receipts, aria records, or whatever. And of course, Telonai and many other officials could read book scripts and sometimes own books, as it was possibly the case of Socrates, the well-known Charanis tax collector, and this is one of his possible books. Familiarity with literature implied that sometimes officials could employ their writing skills for the transcription of literary texts as part of literary pastimes or to satisfy specific commissions. We do not know if the treatise on viticulture on this PSI 624 was written by Zeno, as the first editor suggests, I would say not, by the way, or by someone else of his colleagues. Indeed, the handwriting has strong similarities with the Alexandrian chancery script, so that we consider it a simplified version of the letter. And a similar handwriting, we have already seen it, is found on the famous sheet with the epigrams for the Hound Tauron, sent probably, possibly, but a sort of consolatory letter by someone who was so skilled in the Chancery script to easily bend it to produce a legible column, which would not deface a book roll. The Biblia that Zeno has to metagegrapsai, as we read in this famous letter, Picaer Zen 595-88, had to be in similar scripts, as we find them in a quite a large number of Ptolemaic literary roles, from the Arsinoetes, the Heraclepoetes, and so on. The same happens for the following centuries, not to mention the most obvious of informal literary roles, the Athenaeion Politeia from London. Another remarkable example is Pilon Lit 138, an anthology of rhetoric progymnasmata comprising difficult texts as Tussuasorie and one Nomu Esphora, written, as Herbert Milne writes, in a small cursive hand with abbreviations. It is noteworthy that these works are written on the back of a patchwork of documents, all referring to the Sitologos Acusilaos, that on one of the documents it is possible to read also elegiacs praising Augustus for his victory at Axium, not cancelled when it was pasted with the others to become the role for the progymnasmata, and that on the back of another document of the Sitologos, a hand, which is very close to the one of the elegiacs, wrote a list of books comprising works of poets like Homer and orators. We don't know the names of the writers, but they were surely involved in administrative work, and they used their knowledge of all the documentary practices, from the making of tomoi funcolesimoi to cursive scripts, to pursue their literary pastimes and studies. The issue of becoming familiar with different scripts raised quite soon after the beginning of school. As it is well known, Plato refers that boys quite soon could train in kallos and takos ton grammaton, beautiful and quick scripts. This is a very, very famous passage from the Laws. And though Hellenistic inscriptions awarding prizes for the best students mention only the calligraphia, as one famous catalogue from Theos, surviving school exercises show an uninterrupted consuetude of teaching slower and quicker scripts soon after the very first steps of literacy. Apollonius, son of Glaucias, starts his education copying texts written in a beautiful square script, but almost immediately becomes practiced in a quicker script, as this one. This is one of the first documents written by him, which later develops in what Wilken calls an ungeschichte cursive. This is in the 158 before Christ. 2 centuries later, in Teptunis, a teacher used a well-developed cursive to transcribe an acrostic list of occupations and another acrostic tale, possibly a model for his students, as Raffaele Cribiore writes. And a medley of letters where the strokes are well distincted, and cursive letters is typical of many late antique writing exercises. This is just one of the many tablets. Such graphic osmosis probably lies behind one remarkable feature in the evolution of Greek handwriting during late antiquity, the creation of hybrid scripts, where majuscule and minuscule letter forms coexist. The Byzantine handwriting, called by Italian paleographers scrittura mista, is a normative evolution of such characteristic mixture. You can see it in the marginal notes of this famous manuscript, which is the Vaticanus Graecus 2200. But there is something more. It is well known that young students learned to read and write through the works of centuries-old authors, as Homer. The same texts were used also when someone was training in professional scripts. So it is not surprising that literary phrases are used as models by hands training in elegant majuscule, potentially fitting luxury book rolls. It is what we see on these other papyrus from the Zeno archive, at the top one hexameter, at the end, the simple Andres Dicastai, or on this other, there are hexameter also here, in this Oxyrhynchus papyrus, where someone is writing hexameters to practice with the round majuscule. possible. But such phrases are used also by hands learning or practicing business cursive or chancery scripts. In order to improve and to exercise on the chancery script of Subazianus Aquila, someone wrote six times the beginning of Demosthenes de Corona on one side of a papyrus sheet, this is from the Rylan collection, and on the other a second-hand practice on a different chancery style, using an hexameter from the third book of Iliad, identified quite recently by Lorenzo Sardone in a forthcoming article, Pier Islands 159. The name of the unlucky Aretusa was useful to study the ligature alpha and rho in this fragment from the Laurentiana. The vocative O Andres di Castai was good also for cursive, here on the top of this documentary roll from London, which is the recto of the Politeia rolls, by the way. Similar interactions are so frequent that we can find the same script used for different purposes on the same surface. So, on the back of PSI 1176, we may read the two columns from a new comedy written con ductus corsiveggiante, ductus in Italian meaning, as Paola Degna states, and then, on the same side, the same script typology is used by someone else. You can see on the upper part and also in the space between the two columns, to copy the formula for Nero's sixth regnal year, and it is exactly the same script typology. Such osmosis is confirmed also by an aesthetic aspect. Literary sources almost never praise abstract, elegant scripts. When Lucian satirizes the ignorant book collector, he enumerates the luxury book rolls that the guy added to his library, focusing even on their umbilici, but he never mentions the scripts as a crucial issue. On a different level, when Galen describes his own burned books, their script is never a key classificatory element. The losts that he regrets the most are the hypomnemata and the notes written by previous physicians in their hand. The script has, per se, a communicative value. It may suggest respect, trustfulness, reliability, even a sense of menace. But in ancient sources, the dividing line is not between scripts for literature and scripts for documents, but between legible and not legible scripts. This can be said of literary texts as well as of documents, but texts in non-legible scripts can be as important as text written megalois grammacin. When we look at similar papyri, distinction between literary and documentary papyrology fade. And it should fade away even further if we think that not only the abstract scripts, but also the actual texts were the results of a chain of operations which had many similarities from several points of view. Scrabbling a list of merchandise was different from composing an inspired song, even just because inspirations required the help of the muses and, especially in the Roman Empire, of some slaves. But when complex texts are involved, some common patterns were followed. At least since the age of Plato and Isocrates, extant evidence on the production of literary texts agrees on the distinctions of three phases, where sometimes various writing materials were used. The collection of relevant material and the first draft, often enkerois, a private delivery, usually in front of a selected circle, whose remarks were crucial to reach the final step, the ecdosis, where the almost definitive work was given the status of a proper book. A multi-step process was followed also for complex documentary texts, with many differences, first of all concerning the meaning of publication and the final result when it was an inscription, for example. Again, our indirect evidence traces back to the end of classical age, but it is in Greco-Roman Egypt that we find many more details. One example are petitions. These documents were required to follow the right phraseology in the main text as well as in the introductory clauses and the salutation. Therefore, we find some instances of texts written more than twice before they got the final outlook by the hand of a professional scribe. Ammon wrote nine draft versions of the petition to the Catholicus Flavius Sisinius of December 348, where he struggled for the possession of three slaves, more than Achilles in the Iliad. Amon was a maniacally accurate petitioner, but draft petitions are already attested in the Zeno archive, as Pikaer Zen 59832, a bouillon possibly written by Zeno himself. In petition, as the fort of a single person or family, required less preliminary work than other longer texts released by the manager of large estates, or even more by public officials. The incredible amount of documents produced on a monthly basis by the office of Comogrammateus is an effective elucidation of the complexity of such dynamics in Greco-Roman Egypt. Let us try to sum up. From the classical age to late antiquity, the production of texts appears as a multifaceted unity, a single process, which is shaped according to the communicative requirements of its actors. It can be convenient to focus on one side or the other, on some specific textual instances, or on some technical aspects, the scripts, the layout, the keeping practices, and so on, as a consequence of our scholarly personal interests or for didactic purposes. But when we face the complexity of ancient written products, categories should not become epistemological barriers and lessen ever disciplinary boundaries through sometimes academia seems to love them very much, especially in Italy. If we do not understand this, we risk to betray our final goal, perceiving and explaining the complexity of our past histories. Thank you very much.